This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today is November 5th, 2009. This is the first session in the oral history interview with Frank Kuistra, Associate Dean for Administration of the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. So, Frank, to begin the interview, if you would state for the record your birth date and birthplace, and then talk about who your parents were.
Okay. I was born on December 20th, 1941, a couple weeks after Pearl Harbor.
Wow.
My parents were Ted and Dora Kuistra.
And tell me where you were born.
Woodstock, Illinois. So just down south of the border. My mother lived in Ringwood, Illinois, and my father lived in Hebron, Illinois. My father never graduated from high school. He dropped out after a couple years. My mother completed high school and then worked as a, well, as sort of a, I'll call it a nanny, for several years before they were married in, I believe it was 1920. Well, let's see, no, I'm sorry, that's when they were born. They were married in 1940. So,
where'd they meet?
Well, there's interesting family stories there. My father was a bit of a rebel rouser, never had much appreciation for education. My grandfather, who's my namesake, by the way, immigrated from Holland in 1906. Oh. And became a farmer, a successful farmer, never a rich farmer, but so my father grew up on a dairy farm, and that was sort of his profession. He didn't see much need to go to high school. My mother, on the other hand, was valued education, went through high school, but neither parent ever went to college. So that's who they were, and after they were married, I came along in 1941. Actually, they were actually married in 1941, because I suppose I'll be telling a lot of interesting family secrets in this interview, but I was in college and having a pizza date at Lombardino's when we started, my date and I started talking about, of all things, premarital sex. And I said, well, gosh, I can't imagine in my parents' day that that was anything that was typical behavior. And I said, for example, my parents were married in May, and I was born in December. Let's see. Oops. That's only about 7 months. And I weighed 9 pounds and 6 or 8 ounces, so I wasn't a preemie. Well, that settled that score right there. So I think my father, like I say, was a bit of a rascal. And my mother was a little more serious. And in those days, they had teenage dances. And where they grew up, there was a kind of an old barn that my mother and father took us past several times where they would have Saturday night dances, and that's where the young singles hung out. And my mother and father dated. And then, for some reason, broke up because my mother wrote my father a Dear John letter. And my mother recently passed away, and we were going through her her memorabilia, and we ran across a lot of these old letters. But my father and my mother saved all these letters. He wrote himself back into good graces because eventually they reconciled and, of course, got married. There is some talk of a fight where my mother's boyfriend at the time and my father ended up duking it out out behind the barn. So we never heard the gory details on that, but that's sort of what was passed down in the family stories.
So, Frank, after you were born, was your father drafted for the war?
No, he, in those days, because of his farm background, he got a deferment.
Uh-huh.
And at that time, he was the only son. My father's older brother was killed on his 12th birthday. My grandparents had bought him his first bicycle. And for some reason, they were out on the taking a ride, and my father's brother was standing on the running board of the car. In those days, mm-hmm. we had running boards.
Mm-hmm.
And he fell off, and the car behind them ran over him and killed him.
Oh,
so my father was the only son, and because of that, must have been deferred. So he never went in the Army.
I see.
Yeah.
And so your parents lived on a farm,
yeah.
did they? In Illinois.
Yeah. So I was born in Woodstock, but my parents were renting a farm near Harvard, Illinois.
Oh.
And my brother came along exactly almost a year later. He was born on Christmas Day of 1942. And then I have a sister, and she was born in 1948.
Uh-huh.
So we were living on that farm in Harvard. And when I was 3 years old, we moved to Sharon, Wisconsin. So Sharon, Wisconsin is right on the border.
Oh, down in Walworth County. County.
Yeah. And so I really, the first, I guess I lived on the farm in Sharon until I was in fourth grade. So that would have been till about age 10. So mm-hmm. we were in Sharon for about 7 to 10 years. And then we moved to a farm just north of Sharon. So from that time on, I went to Darien, which is, again, nearby.
Now, in each case, did your parents own the farm, or were they renting
yeah.
it?
My grandparents owned the farm that we moved to in Sharon. And so my father rented the land from and the farm from my grandparents. When we moved to Darien, my father's sister and husband lived on the farm north of Sharon, and they, for health reasons, had to move to Florida.
Oh.
And so then my parents moved onto that farm because it was larger than the farm that we had in Sharon.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, we had basically 120 acres. We milked 25 dairy cows.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a pretty small operation.
Mm-hmm.
But my parents, technically the farm is still in the family. My brother lives on the farm. But my mother, as I said, recently passed away, and she sold the farm on land contract to a cousin.
Uh-huh.
None of us kids went into farming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So off record, I'll tell you later how I know so much about Walworth County. What kind of cows did your family have?
Yeah.
Holsteins?
They were grade Holsteins. So we didn't have a purebred operation at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess looking back on growing up on the farm, those were interesting years. They sort of build your character.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think my family today quite understands why I get up at 5:30 in the morning still. But of course, we were up at 5 o'clock every day and milking cows, and then you'd have to come in and essentially wash up and get dressed for school. My parents allowed us to participate in some sports, but pretty much we were expected to come home after school and do chores and milk the cows, and then basically evening was homework. We didn't have TV until basically until I was about in high school. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of where we were then.
Now, you know, when you say character, and I understand getting up at 5 a.m., as you think back on it, you know, and look at your own family now, can you elaborate a little bit on what you mean by character? You know, because one does hear, certainly in the mythology, that farm kids grow up differently and are more mature, perhaps, or so. I'd be interested in how you think about that now.
Well, I think it instilled a sense of discipline, because there's no time off. Mm-hmm. Basically, there was a routine every day, 7 days a week. Mm-hmm. You were able to deviate from that a little bit on the weekend, where the family would maybe take a Sunday drive to visit relatives, or the Saturday barn dances. So there was plenty of social life, but everything was pretty disciplined. A strong sense of family values, because everyone had their role. And you perform your role. The other thing that I think I could say is there was a strong sense of ethics and honesty. Sure. I know that was instilled in me. We might talk about this later, but I ended up in the military going to officer candidate school and was elected the honor code chairman. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why that happened, mm-hmm. but basically, even today, I tell my kids, you know, don't lie. Your credibility means everything. So I said, even if it means, you know, some sort of discipline or whatever, you're best coming clean with things. And I think growing up on the farm, that really... Mm-hmm. Instill that into my family. Mm-hmm. I don't know, the town kids, you always envied the town kids. The town kids went home from school, would play and go out and throw the ball around, and we always went home and milk cows.
Mm-hmm. So even as a young boy, were you milking?
Yeah. We milk cows. Well, I went to Delavan Dairy Inn High School, and I was very small for my size. Oh. When I graduated from high school, I was 5'6". Now I'm about 6 foot even. Mm-hmm. In my peak, I was probably 6'5", but I'm in the declining stage now. And I went to Dairy Inn High School, and we merged with Delavan in my junior year. Mm-hmm. Dairy Inn High School had 27 boys when I was there as a sophomore, and we played six-man football. Mm-hmm. And I was probably 85 pounds soaking wet, so I might have been an athletic, but I was not an athlete. Mm-hmm. So when we merged with Delavan, that was a pretty big deal. That was a big town. Mm-hmm. I ended up taking 2 years of ag, the VOAG program.
In high school.
And graduated with absolutely no idea where I wanted, what I wanted to do or where I was going. Ironically, because I wanted to be part of the in crowd, while most of the farm kids were taking shop and metalwork and woodworking and voag, I took voag, but I also took chemistry, English. I took all the college courses, not because I was going to college. I had no interest in going to college, but that's where all my friends were. I didn't have my group of friends in the more trade or blue collar type programs in the high school. So when everyone graduated, I decided to come to Farm and Industry Short Course. So my time here predates 1961. I actually came here in 1959 to the college's short course program.
Oh, interesting.
So I am a graduate of short course, of the four-year program, and my master's degree at Wisconsin.
Frank, before we get into that, I want to ask, was your mother influential in your taking pre-college courses?
No.
So this was really your decision?
Strictly had to do with social interaction, yeah.
What was the VOAG program like? Did you learn anything in high school?
Well, yeah. I was an officer in the Future Farmers of America.
Uh-huh.
It provided some leadership opportunities. Obviously, I was interested in agriculture. I wasn't really looking at farming as a career because I'd milked cows all those years and I was really looking for something else. But obviously, I had no direction. I really took the farm short course program because it was an opportunity to take a peek at something else. The VOAG instructor, Mr. Holman, we had a scholarship to come up to Madison. And there were two boys in the class, Tom Delaney and myself, and he split that. Years later, he said he should have given me the whole scholarship because Tom went off and got all messed up in other things. And of course, this was my entry into college because I got up here and started to go to classes, started to appreciate the opportunities that a college education would give me. And the other thing is, after that first summer, after high school graduation, it was amazing when all of these friends that I hung with all through high school, and they had their collegiate curriculum in high school, they went off to college. By the first week after Labor Day, Labor Day, I was lonely. They were off, and I was all alone. Farm Short Course started on November 15th. Mm-hmm. So from September and October and half of November, I didn't have anyone to even associate with. That probably had more of an impact on me than anything, because when I came up here to Short Course, I said, boy, I'm going to toe the line here, and my goal is to try to see if I can make it in college.
Mm-hmm. What was the short course like then, in those days?
It was unbelievable. I was in a class on milk marketing with Truman Graff and Frank. The name will come to me, but Truman Graff taught this milk marketing course, Frank Groves. And these kids did not come here for an education. First of all, Truman and Frank were not the most entertaining lecturers. Mm-hmm. In fact, even today's students half expect to be entertained in the classroom. Mm-hmm. Well, it was embarrassing because Truman was trying to lecture and there were paper airplanes and it was just chaotic. And it was embarrassing to me because I was there to try to learn and these kids were there to more to party in some respects.
Mm-hmm.
It was a good program, but I'd have to say that today's program is much better than it was back then.
Frank, I take it, though, by the time you graduated from high school, you had not made a decision to reject agriculture.
No.
You sort of saw your life in some aspect of agriculture, if not milking cows for the rest of your life.
Yeah, for sure, not milking cows. But I didn't have any plan.
Yeah.
There was no plan. So it was really the opportunity to get into short course that led me into higher education. I met Jack King. The short course students were in rooms based on the alphabet. So Jack King was my roommate. He was from Burlington, Wisconsin, and we hit it off right away. After 1 year in short course, Jack and I decided that we were going to enroll the next year then in the 4-year program. So we had had enough exposure to ag campus life through the short course program that we knew that there were a couple of fraternities, Alpha Gamma Rho and Delta Theta Sigma, and there was Babcock House.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, we went up to Alpha Gamma Rho towards the end of our first year in a short course. And in those days, I have to say that the academic standards were much lower than they are today.
Mm-hmm.
Based on my high school academic record, which was not stellar by any stretch of the imagination, because I didn't care in high school
mm-hmm.
whether I got a C or a D, as mm-hmm. long as I didn't get an F.
Mm-hmm.
And I could pull a B or a C by not even really studying.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all that mattered, if I could just hang with the crowd. So on one hand, I was academically prepared because I had the English and the math and the science.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I did not perform well in those because I really wasn't looking at a college as the next step.
Mm-hmm.
So when I entered college, I remember the night before I attended my first class, and in those days I was recruited right into Alpha Gamma Rho, so I was a pledge. And I never lived in the dormitory. I moved right into the house up mm-hmm. on 1820 Summit Avenue. And three times in my life when I was actually, intimidated by what was ahead of me. The night before attending my first class, I remembered really wondering if I was going to be able to pull this off.
Are you're enrolled in letters and science?
No,
or
I was
the
ag program. Yeah,
ag
I
program.
Enrolled in the College of Ag as a freshman. The next time was when I took the 6-week chemistry 1 exam because I had no idea where I was or what I was doing. And the third time that I was really afraid of an exam, and we can get into this later, but I was getting out of school at the height of the Vietnam War,
mm-hmm.
and my draft board clerk had already told me I was 2 weeks away from being drafted.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to get into the Navy, the Air Force. They weren't taking anyone. I was destined for the Army, and I said, well, if I'm going to go in the Army, I'm going to be an officer. And everything depended on my entrance exams, and I knew I had to score well. And so those were the three times that I was really worried about any kind of academic endeavor.
Frank, before we get into your academic career at UW, what was the university like in those days? You know, it's, you and I know what it's like today. What was it like when you were here in 60 and 61?
Yeah. Well, the academic standards were a lot lower. Mm-hmm. There wasn't the competition to get into the university that we have today. I was probably as challenged because of my lack of preparation, but I think even today, there's, you know, with the upper 10% getting into the UW-Madison, the competition here is just really fierce, I think. And it probably wasn't as fierce in those early days. Women had hours. So there was a whole, especially in the fraternity life, we would have our parties and the women had to be in by 12:30. Mm-hmm. And by 12:45, we were back in the fraternity house continuing to party, singing songs, the frat songs. And it was in my junior, senior year where they abolished women's hours. Well, that ruined those late night parties that the guys used to have down in the kitchen. So that was an interesting, the social life, I think, was a bit different. We had beer all the time. Fraternities now, my fraternity doesn't have beer on site at all.
Oh, it doesn't?
No. So, you know, the whole, I think alcohol is still a factor, especially in our Wisconsin culture, mm-hmm. but not like what we had. Now, there was no abuse. I can't remember any of my fraternity brothers that ever abused alcohol, mm-hmm. but it was clearly a factor. Mm-hmm. So that's changed. Obviously, the place has gotten a lot bigger here in that regard. The other thing that changed, I think, you know, I remember the Little International. Boy, the Little International was a big thing on this campus.
What is it?
That was the International Livestock Show, Livestock and Horse Show. It was over in the Stock Pavilion. It was a three-day event, a Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday matinee. Mm-hmm. And there were horse barrel races. There were equestrian events. It was the fraternities had a tug of war. Uh-huh. There was a greased pig chase. And we packed that place. And, of course, that's all gone now. Mm-hmm. That's all changed.
I suppose the student population was much smaller.
Much smaller, yeah. Football was still big. I remember we beat Ohio State when they were number one in basketball. I can still remember most of the players on that team because we weren't even ranked in those days, and Ohio State was number one. They had Havlicek and forget some of their players, but we had Tom Gwynn and Mike Heerden and, now I forget the rest of them, but we played solid basketball and beat them, and what a party that was up at the house afterwards. It was a lot of fun.
Now, your fraternity house wasn't on Langdon Street.
No.
Together.
We were at 1820 Summit Avenue, which is up in the University Heights. It's at the top of the hill up there. Right now, it's a living co-op. It became obvious that to remain competitive, we had to move to Langdon Street. And eventually, Delta Theta Sigma moved to Langdon Street as well. The only house that's still where it was is Babcock House over on University Avenue. Mm-hmm. But we moved down to Langdon Street then. Well, not while I was in school, but years later, the fraternity relocated.
So, Frank, tell me about your 4 years in ag. Mm-hmm. What significant mm-hmm. faculty courses you took, mm-hmm. what was difficult, what was exciting and interesting mm-hmm. for you?
Mm-hmm. Well, I started out in agronomy and quickly changed to soils. and finally ended up in food science. It took me a while to find out just where I fit in, but food science turned out to be an excellent a curriculum for me. And the other thing that was a little bit different in those days, that they took attendance class. And if you missed more than two classes, you were reported to Dean Kivlin up in Ag Hall, and you had to go see the dean. So it became kind of a point of teasing, where if you were called to the dean's office, everyone knew it. And of course, Dean Kivlin gave you the same speech almost every time. He had a standard speech. And he smoked Kent cigarettes, and he'd sit there rolling that cigarette while you were being reprimanded for your tardiness or your absenteeism. But my professor, my advisor was Elsie Thompson in food science. I remember Jim Love in soils, all the professors in food science. Amundsen, Winder was the ice cream guy. They were all quite, Harold Calbert was the department chair. I guess I finally settled into food science about halfway through my sophomore year and just stayed with food science then till the end. And I had the business option, so I took a minimum amount of food science courses. Most of my courses were over in the business school.
Oh.
And I always thought that was a little, I think things have changed now, but you used to fill out a 3x5 card when you checked into a new course, and you'd put your major on there. And I always felt that we were discriminated against to some extent academically.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, there was just a feeling that those majoring in pre-business got a break. And you got that impression just how you were dealt with in class, looking at how exams were graded, because you could compare your grade with your business school or pre-business college, fellow student. And it just looked like, I think we were maybe a little bit, maybe it was just a sore point. I just really felt that we were not given the breaks that our colleagues were.
Now that's interesting, Frank. Was that a function of the business school faculty feeling ag and ag students were lesser?
Possibly, or that they just really didn't want the burden of dealing with these students that are obviously not going into business. But in food science, we had a business option. And of course, the food industry was a big industry. And there was a high demand for graduates. A lot of that demand, though, was in the technical sciences, especially in food science, where we had people that were actually studying organic chemistry and a lot of the more basic aspects of food and food processing. The business option was for guys like myself that really wanted to go into marketing and more management. But I think the business school expected those slots to be filled by their own grads and not by College of Ag grads. Anyway, that's kind of a pet peeve of mine that dates back to those early years.
And Frank, what was it about the field of food science that lured you away from soils?
I think it was the fact that I really wanted to get into some kind of more management, and I didn't see the opportunities in soils and agronomy that were available to graduates of food science. You know, if you looked at Foremost Dairies or some of the Carnation or Kraft or some of the big food companies. There were opportunities there with their sort of after you were hired, you were put through a whole administrative indoctrination. You know, they'd bring you through their own kind of indoctrination course, and that's what I was shooting for. I wanted to be a plant manager or some kind of a marketing specialist. And so that really held me. Later in college, I ended up working. Well, first of all, I went back to the farm between my freshman and sophomore year, but after that I worked in Madison. Initially, I worked at Babcock Hall making ice cream.
Oh, you did?
So I was right there in the dairy plant. Somewhere in my junior year, I had a friend that was working with the Statistical Reporting Service and the Crop Reporting Service. The Crop Reporting Service was state. The Statistical Reporting Service was federal, but it was one unit. And he said, why don't you come down and get a student job there? And I started working down at the Capitol then as part of that statistical ag statistic reporting. And I worked there then until I actually graduated from college. And instead of going into food work, I ended up working for the U.S. government prior to going in the military. But it was so boring. I had maybe 3 hours of work. I was a GS-5 initially, and I had about 3 hours of work, and then I just had to make myself look busy. The most interesting thing I had in that job was right before going in the Army, I ran a big survey on the disappearing dairy farmer and got that published. That almost lured me back into that business once I got out of college, but I knew that was not what I did not want to work for the federal government. And we can probably get into that later, but I really like food science.
Now, Frank, what are your parents thinking at this point of your going on in college and becoming college educated and clearly moving into perhaps headed for the higher ranks?
Well, they were very supportive. First of all, we didn't have much money. It didn't cost that much, and I worked all 4 years. I had a regular job. So I actually contributed a lot, but so did they. And we didn't have a lot of money, so it wasn't easy. And then my younger brother followed me into college, and eventually my sister went to college. So they put all three of us through college.
All here at the UW?
All here. Well, my sister, no. The two boys went here. My sister went to Oshkosh. But they were very supportive. And I think my father hoped that I would come back to the farm. But it just wasn't big enough. We still only had 25 milk cows, and it was pretty obvious. And then in my, I think it was my junior year, my father suffered a massive heart attack, almost died. And I dropped out of school for one semester, went home and milked the cows and ran the farm. And my brother stayed in college. And then we sold the cows in March. And I came back to school that following fall then. And so my father stayed on the farm and recuperated and got into other things, but we stopped farming.
You stopped dairy farming or the, farming altogether?
Stopped farming. He still rented out the land, and he got into nursery business. He actually became quite good at designing landscapes, even though he had no training. He started working for them, and they trained him as a salesman to go out get business. And then he would draw up the plot of the land and the house on a grid and send it to the office, and they would design the planting area then. And he'd take pictures so they could get a feel for the area. Well, he saw what they did, and he started doing it himself.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So, but it was obvious that none of the family was going to stay in farming.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So, before we get you graduated, any other subjects in college that were of interest to you?
Well, all the business school courses, even though I felt a little disadvantaged, I really enjoyed them. I was in ROTC for 2 years.
Oh.
When I first got into college, it was compulsory, and then it became voluntary. I think it was compulsory the first 2 years, and then you could choose. And I got out because I thought, well, I really don't want to go in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
Well, about the junior years when the Vietnam War was picking up. So at the time I graduated...
Which is June of 65?
It was June of 65, right, because I had that... I actually had ended up with a five-year collegiate career. One semester was out,
mm-hmm.
and then
right.
I just, with changing majors, I ended up having to go 9 semesters instead of 8. But coming out of college then, I was engaged, and my fiance had one more year of college. And I started working for the federal government in Statistical Reporting Service.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was deferred because I was married.
Oh, you got married right after graduation.
Yeah, so we were married the summer after graduation. But then, because they needed more troops, the deferment was only for those that had dependents. And I was not going to start a family simply to get out of the Army. So mm-hmm. I called my draft board clerk, and I said, where?
In Delavan?
Yeah, in Elkhorn.
Oh, Elkhorn.
Yeah. And her name was Letty Shaw. Never met the woman, but we all knew the draft board clerk. And I asked her where I stood, and she said, well, your number comes up in about 2 weeks. So, I tried to enlist and get into the military.
Mm-hmm.
But your question was more about what else strikes me as my collegiate career. And I think Alpha Gamma Rho was a big influence on me in many respects because of my poor academic preparation. Really helped me get through school.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Even today, some of my best friends, we still stay in touch. It goes back to those days and up on Summit Avenue.
And the fraternity was exclusively guys in ag?
Yeah.
So mostly Wisconsin boys?
No. I remember we had one from the state of Washington, actually 2 from the state of Washington, a couple from Illinois, but mostly Wisconsin, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Jack King was right there,
right.
And we went through the 4 years together,
right.
Yeah, dating all the way back to a short course,
right.
Yeah.
Now, when you're in ag, do you have some liberal arts requirements?
Oh, yeah.
Is there a writing requirement? Is there some math or other electives that you have to take?
Yeah. Even back then, we didn't have a foreign language requirement. And actually, I regret that because that really could have helped me later in life.
Mm-hmm.
But all of the other requirements are the same. Basically, the first 2 years of college are pretty much a standard LNS curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
Because they wanted to get you involved in ag early, you had your survey courses. And of course, if you were, as I was, an agronomy or soils major, each semester you'd probably take one ag course. And then start to fill that out with more ag courses once you got through those early years, because the first 2 years were all math and chemistry and English.
Mm-hmm.
So the curriculum is, I would say, just as rigorous as anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And it was tough because, I wasn't really academically prepared. It was a lot of nights at the library.
Was it the case for the university in those days that basically anyone who was a high school graduate could get in here, and then there was that enormous flunk out after the first or second semester?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't think they say that anymore, but I remember sitting in freshman lecture the very first week, and I don't even remember who said this anymore, but they said, look to your left and your right, because two of those people won't be there, and you may be one of them. I mean, there was at least a 30, 40, 50% dropout rate. So there was a lot of people that dropped out in those days.
So
I think people are so academically prepared now that you don't have the same kind of dropout rate that you had then.
I have heard about that statement.
Yeah.
I've never met anybody who said it's actually true.
It happened. I was sitting there because it impacted me, because I knew I was skating on thin ice, and I thought, boy, oh boy, it scared the bejesus out of me, because the first 6 weeks, I think I just literally studied every night.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, I didn't feel like I was ready to get into these exams.
Mm-hmm.
But we made it.
You made it.
Yeah.
And you ended up running Cal's, but
yeah.
We'll get there eventually.
Yeah.
So you're graduated and you're married and you've talked to the draft board clerk, and you end up in the military.
Yeah.
So, and had the campus been active protesting yet, or
no.
Was the war not an issue?
It was not an issue at that time.
Uh-huh.
I looked at every reserve unit in town.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't get in a reserve unit. Anyone that could see what was coming and had taken steps to make sure they didn't get trapped.
Mm-hmm.
And like I say, once the draft board clerk told me that I was 2 weeks from being drafted, I went to the Navy, I went to the Air Force. They were taking it, you had to have a 3.75 GPA to get into either of those programs, or they wouldn't even look at you.
The OCS programs.
Yes, the OCS mm-hmm. programs. Or even, and then they wouldn't even let you in. They were filling their quotas easily, so they weren't taking anyone here.
Mm-hmm.
My only choice was the Army.
Mm-hmm.
So I enlisted for Officer Candidate School.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, there's a test score that they call the GT test score. General testing, and a lot of that was dependent upon me getting into OCS, and I scored close to the highest score on that test.
Uh-huh.
So I always felt kind of proud about that, because I came from this kind of ill-prepared background.
Mm-hmm.
Worked hard to get through college, but once I took this general test, I remember my test score was like 144, and passing was like 100 or whatever, and top score was 150.
Wow.
So I was in the upper percentile.
Mm-hmm.
On that test score. And as a result, got into the military and got enlisted for, I was given orders to OCS from the time I entered service. I knew where I was going. And probably this isn't related to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, but and I don't know how much of this you want to actually record, but the day I got on the troop train in Milwaukee and went down to Chicago, and we sat at Union Station all night long. We left about 2 a.m. for Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. And they finally announced that you had to get on the troop train about 11:30. And I had delayed getting on as long as I could. And I got on the troop train, and it was a sleeper. And of course, most of the inductees at that time were from Chicago and right off the street. And I got in that troop train, and there were probably about 16, 18 people. I took the bunk just inside the door, but my, I guess, train mates were all drunk. And I had a white shirt and tie on with a sweater. And the first thing they did, they sized me up, and they came down and they took my ticket and my luggage and sat me down on the bunk after taking all my stuff and started molesting me.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And there was a fellow inductee that came through that had a red armband, and he was no different than I was. When he got on the train, they handed him this red armband with sergeant stripes and said, "You're in control." And so I later knew this guy. We ended up in the same company in basic training. And I said, "These guys took my suitcase and they're bothering me." And he said, "Hey, I got problems." He said, "Don't me feed you. I've got more problems than I can handle. You're on your own." And just left me. So I was getting pretty worried and I didn't know what to do. And not a whole lot of time had transpired, but it felt like hours.
Yes.
And in walked this black staff sergeant with 3 decks of ribbons, Vietnam veteran, who had gotten out of the service and was reenlisting because he couldn't find a job. The guy was massive. He looked like Sonny Liston. And the bunk across from me was open, and he sat down on that bunk, and we said hello and exchanged pleasantries, and he had a flask that he pulled out of his breast pocket, and he offered me a swallow, and I took it. And I said, "You know," I said, "I've only been on this train for about 20 minutes, but," I said, "I won't go into all the details, but these guys down here took my suitcase and my train ticket, and so I have nothing." Man, oh man, did he shake things up. I had my suitcase back. I had my train ticket. I had everything, and he was my savior, because I knew that night I was in trouble if something didn't happen. And I slept like a baby after that. Never saw the guy again in my whole life, but that was one of the worst experiences I had going into the Army.
I can't imagine.
Yeah, they were actually trying to rub me, and then they'd take off and laugh, and then they'd come back and harass
me. And I take it these were all black guys.
No, not all black. It was mixed. The night we graduated from basic training, we turned in our stuff until late at night. And when I got back to the dorm room, Dan Johnson from La Crosse was hiding under his bed. These hoods had come in and beat him up. And he said, "Frank, get out of here. They're looking for you." Because we had established ourselves as college grads. I mean, everyone. I mean,
yes.
These were street guys. And they just really wanted to get us. So I was going to try to get out. And I was out in the hallway, and I could hear him coming. I mean, what these guys did, they took mop handles and put him in the front-leaning rest and jabbed him. I mean, he was in bad shape. So I went back into the room, and Dan said, "If they come in here," he said, "I tell them I haven't seen you." And I hid under the bed. And they never got me, but that was a rough crowd.
Very
it was a rough crowd. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that goes on in today's Army, but it did then.
Mm-hmm. Well, you still hear horror stories.
Yeah,
today.
Yeah.
So you got to Fort Leonard Wood, and that's where basic took place
for 8 weeks, and then from there we went 8 weeks to officer prep school at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. And then there were 6 months of officer candidate training at Fort Sill in artillery. And then 1/3 of my class went right to Vietnam. 1/3 of the class went into missiles and went to Germany. That was me.
Uh-huh.
And 1/3 of the class went to units in the U.S. waiting for deployment to Vietnam in a year.
Do you know how they decided on who went where?
You filled out what the Army called a dream sheet. And you had to list one combat arm. But of course, I put quartermaster was my first choice because I was a food science grad. So I figured, okay, this is good. No way, I wasn't going to get quartermaster. I forget what else I chose, but my combat arm was field artillery, and so I was given field artillery OCS.
Mm-hmm.
I think all my military scores were very high, so I was in the upper, my test scores were all in the upper 5 to 10%. My leadership skills and my academic record through officer candidate school was in the upper 10%. And I think that's what got me into Pershing missiles, because of it was computer driven, electronics, a lot of math required, and it got me off the field artillery. Graduate is a forward observer. You've got a pair of binoculars and a radio, mm-hmm. and you're out there in Vietnam calling artillery fire on various hot spots.
Yeah.
It's not a real pleasant place to be.
No, and I'm sure the mortality rate was quite high.
Yeah, you were out there with a sergeant and a radio operator and yourself, usually a team of three, sitting on a hill somewhere, calling in field artillery fire, so you really had no security whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
So you're pretty vulnerable.
So you finished training before the end of 65, or
yeah.
Are we into 66 yet?
I finished training in 66. I went into the service this would have been 67, I think, because I graduated in 65, I got married. We actually lived here, and I worked for a year. So I think I went into the service in March of 66.
Okay.
No, March of 67 it was.
Okay, you say here on your CV, May of 66 to March of 69.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Do you want this?
So, yeah, so I went in May of 66, right, ended up in Germany then in a Pershing missile unit.
Where in Germany were you sent?
Oh, it was nice. Initially right on the Rhine River in Mainz.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were transferred to a place down in Bavaria called New Ulm. So I was 1 year on the Rhine River, and then 1 year down in the Bavarian area, the Black Forest area. Very nice.
Was your wife with you?
Yes. And I brought her over there on my own, because in order to be accompanied, you had to sign up for 3 years, 4 years. But I didn't want to do that, so we paid to have her come over.
I see.
And because of that, we got temporary quarters. And We didn't get the nice permanent quarters, but we had a really nice time.
Now, so you were officer, you were commanding troops.
Yeah, I was second lieutenant initially, and I commanded a platoon of about 100 men. And then I became the platoon leader. I was as a first lieutenant, but then I was about ready. I could have become a captain had I stayed on, mm-hmm. but I ended up getting out.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say you were working on a Pershing missile unit, what did that mean exactly? What were you all responsible for?
Well, the Pershing missile is a surface-to-surface missile, long range. Mm-hmm. So, and it has nuclear capability. Mm-hmm. So we had a top secret clearance. We were stationed on a field site. We had a 12-week rotation. So you were off for 12 weeks with no duty.
Oh.
And then you were in a preparation status for 3 weeks prior to going on active field site duty with nuclear weapons on site for 3 weeks. And then you were standing down and you went through what was called a maintenance 3 weeks. You mm-hmm. maintain equipment. So while in Germany, we were housed in trailers and slept on site during the 3 weeks that we were on duty. We couldn't leave the site. Mm-hmm. But the 3 weeks prior to that, until we had nuclear weapons on site, we could actually come and go. Mm-hmm. And then when we were back in barracks, of course, we were living at home. Mm-hmm. The Pershing missile was the surface-to-surface nuclear capability of the Army at that time. I don't even think they have them anymore. I think time has passed them by.
Frank, had the Berlin Wall gone up?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tensions were high, yeah. I assume.
Yeah, we actually, we got to do some traveling. And the warrant officer and a fellow lieutenant and myself and our wives actually went into Berlin. But we had to go by train, and so you had to go through East Germany to get to Berlin, and we needed special permission to do that. And so we were held and guarded by the East Germans while we were traveling through East Germany. Mm-hmm. The warrant officer actually got permission to go into East Berlin. Now, we never did, because the two lieutenants had security clearances that wouldn't allow us to go in. Mm-hmm. But that was very interesting. To see Berlin at that time, you had a dark side where there were no lights at all. Mm-hmm. And then you had, you couldn't compare West Berlin to Las Vegas with all the lights, but you had neon lights, you had advertising, you had really a Western city, mm-hmm. and then you looked across and it was just dark. They had no electricity, no nightlife, no life at all, it looked mm-hmm. like to me. It was a very interesting time.
I bet.
Yeah.
Now, back with your platoon was being a commander or being in charge, were you pretty comfortable with that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I really enjoyed that. Of course, we had heavy equipment. We had a lot to take care of. We had nuclear weapons. My platoon was flown back to White Sands, New Mexico, once to go through a whole field test, including shooting. Now, we shot a dummy warhead, uh-huh. but, of course, that was the only time I got to press the fire button. So the warrant officer and I actually, there were two buttons. You had to press them simultaneously. He pressed one, I pressed the other one. we fired that missile 320 miles, and according to the report, we landed 15 feet to the left of the target and about 30 feet short. Well, this is a nuclear warhead. It was a bullseye. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was really interesting.
Yeah, I bet.
While we were there, when we got our rest and recuperation, we got to spend some time in Mexico.
Oh.
So we were in Juarez.
Oh, you were.
And, of course, we were all married, so we behaved ourselves. But that was an interesting experience. But I enjoyed that. Well, I enjoyed it so much, when I actually got out of the Army, I was in the Army Reserve for 20 more years.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, I retired as a lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserve. So I enjoyed it that much that I stayed.
Did you, as you think back on your accomplishments to date, do you ever think about wondering, had you stayed in the military and made the military a career, does that...
I had a chance while I was in Germany to take an extension and make captain.
Uh-huh.
And I had actually decided to do that when, actually four of us decided to do it, and two of those four came down on orders for Vietnam. Well, I didn't extend to go to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and I asked to be released from my obligation, and luckily they did. But the only reason I wanted to stay is that I enjoyed the experience in Europe so much that I thought, well, let's stay another year. What does that hurt?
Mm-hmm.
I had paid off all my school debt while I was in the military. I was debt-free for probably the only time in my life. But I'll give you a story about the military. When I was a lieutenant, we didn't have lawyers. We had the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and all military discipline was handled on a duty roster by lieutenants. So if we had somebody that was being court-martialed, your name came up on a duty roster as a defense counsel for that soldier.
Oh.
And I had, after some time, soldiers were requesting me as their defense counsel because I would defend them. And I got called into a colonel's office once in the middle of a trial and told that my job was not to defend them. My job was to see that they got fair discipline, not to defend them. So I was pretty much told to back off and let's send this guy off to prison. That told me right there that I was not interested in the military. Now, it wasn't many years after that that the military actually discarded the whole justice system. And they actually, all trials were required to be led by actual legal counsel.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't the case when I was a young lieutenant. Mm-hmm. I defended three people and probably got them pretty much the minimum. And then I was being requested. I didn't really want that status. I just wanted to do my job,
mm-hmm.
But evidently I was doing it too well.
Mm-hmm.
So I liked the military, but there were aspects that it wasn't a career choice mm-hmm. for me. No.
So you get out in May of 69,
yeah.
I think. And what happens then exactly? Do you know what
yeah.
you're going to do?
No. I got a letter from a fraternity brother who was working in Ag Hall. And my option was to go back to the Statistical Reporting Service. Scotty Walters was the leader of that out at the Hill Farm State Office building.
Oh, yeah.
And he had written to me and said, well, I could come back because my seniority had continued. I'd come back as a GS-9, which wasn't a bad salary level. But I remembered my days as a GS-5 and an entry-level GS-7. And I said, no way do I want to get back in there. I wanted to get my master's degree.
Oh, you knew then that you wanted to get a master's.
I really thought I wanted to get back and go back to school. Well, ironically, my friend wrote me a letter and said, well, what are you doing when you get back? And I said, well, Lori, I don't know. I said, I guess I could go back working for the feds, but I'd like to go back to school on the GI Bill. So he said, well, why don't you come in to Ag Hall when you get back, and I'll show you around. He said, I'm leaving my job in Ag Hall, and they're looking for a replacement, or will be. There was no PVL, no posting. Mm-hmm. I came in, met Lori. He took me in and introduced me to Bob Bray, who was an animal scientist, associate dean, and Bob Hogus, who was a plant scientist and associate dean, both in Ag Hall working for Glenn Pound.
Uh-huh.
And I walked in and met them, and we just talked, and they said, well, what do you think about coming to work for us? And I said, wow. I said, I wouldn't mind that. They said, well, you're hired. So that was it. That was
this
it.
This is astounding.
There was no posting.
So this is 1969.
1969. Yeah, just walked in, and in those days, they just hired you right to a job. $8,750 was my annual salary. That was my starting salary. And so I reported to work in 2 weeks.
And what was that position?
That was an administrative specialist. I don't know what I said there.
You say administrative specialist, research division.
Yeah, that's what it was, yeah. So I started as an administrative specialist. I really ran their hatch program, the federal hatch funds that come into the college.
Uh-huh.
Now they were, the two Bobs were the scientific administrators. I was the financial accountant. And so I did all the budgeting, all of the accounting, and the processing of requisitions, all the administrative duties.
And you had had, presumably, some budgeting and accounting in the business track when you were an undergraduate.
Right, yeah.
So you were comfortable and happy?
Oh, very happy. I mean, I actually used the GI Bill. By that time, when we got back here, we had our first child. Within a year, we had the second child, and mm-hmm. another year, we had the third child. So three girls came along right after that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to go to school. My wife was doing substitute teaching, and we were doing okay.
So you were working and working on your master's part-time?
Yeah. The rule said you could take 4 credits a semester, but I was sneaking 6 and 8, but nobody was watching. So I was actually being given some release time from work to go to class. And although I had a business option on my BS degree, I had a lot of credits. I had to make up 30 credits of B school before I even got admitted to grad school.
Mm-hmm.
So it took me roughly about 2 years just to do all the prereqs.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, I had to go through the master's degree course curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
I bet you I have close to 180 credits.
Really?
Yeah. Because I had 124 to graduate with a BS.
Mm-hmm.
And then I must have taken at least 60 to 70 credits just to get my master's degree.
Wow. Now, again, I want to ask some perspective. What's the ag school like at this point?
Things have really changed. Well, first of all, we had a lot more faculty when I started. There was a greater sense of collegiality, a greater sense of loyalty to department, loyalty to college. I mean, we used to have recognition banquets where we'd fill Ag Hall or Memorial Union, the Great Hall. Jumping forward to today, the faculty are loyal to their research, their laboratory. They're probably not even that loyal to their department, but they know they need a department to survive, to carry out the things they do. Mm-hmm. I think today's faculty are much more entrepreneurial. I mean, it's fantastic the programs that these people develop and the type of research they're doing. Not that the research in the early days wasn't any less important, but there wasn't as much time spent in that arena. We were a research institution, but I just think that today what we put young faculty through is far greater than what they were put through when I first started. Mm-hmm. You know, the track through tenure wasn't nearly as rigorous as I think it is now. Mm-hmm. So that's one major change. I think the fact that there was a lot more camaraderie and loyalty to institution and not so much now. We have less faculty, they're more engaged in just their research and their science than they were in those days.
Now, in 1969, when you're there, is Wisconsin's Ag School well-regarded nationally?
Always. It's always been either number one, depending on who you talk to, it's either Wisconsin or Cornell.
Uh-huh.
Those are the two schools that are seen as the elite schools.
Then and now?
And now, yeah. Nothing's changed. Mm-hmm. I think there's been some closure of that, but we've all suffered budget cuts equally. I mean, it doesn't matter where you are. Mm-hmm. You've had budget and programmatic cuts. Wisconsin is set apart by what we've done in two areas, WRF, mm-hmm. how we handle intellectual property that provides funds that really support the research engine. And within the College of Agriculture, we get our hatch funds, which are the federal formula funds that go to all land-grant colleges like ours. Mm-hmm. And we have kept that pool of money, and we only allocated in competitive grants. We have an internal grants program. Hmm. And I maintain that any new professor that comes into our college is forced to apply for a hatch grant. There's no doubt they're going to get it, mm-hmm. but there's a peer review process that trains them in grant writing. Mm-hmm. As opposed to our sister colleges elsewhere that take these hatch funds as block grants and just kind of spread it out over. And if you look at Wisconsin, even in the last year, we've had significant increases in federal research funding. Mm-hmm. Because our faculty are so, well, first of all, they're so smart. Mm-hmm. And we don't hire but the best. Mm-hmm. And we train them on how to write a grant, and there's a peer group or a mentoring group that puts them through that rigorous first 2 or 3 years. And I think that pays dividends, mm-hmm. because we've seen no fall off on how competitive we are relative to our competition. Mm-hmm. Our people are really good.
Mm-hmm. Now, 1969, when you come back here and you're here, 69, 70, 71, is a pretty tumultuous time
Very.
On campus.
I sat in an accounting exam where we had tear gas floating in through the window. I mean, I was crying. Mm-hmm. I could hardly take the exam. I walked through picket lines because I was here to get an education and nobody was going to keep me from my class. I paid good money, mm-hmm. or someone paid good money since I was on the GI Bill. And I got harassed by busting picket lines. Mm-hmm. I was in an economics course, quiz section, where they knew I was a military veteran, and I felt very uncomfortable in that class, and finally was asked by the TA what I thought about the draft. And I said, well, I said, at the risk of really upsetting some people, it should be mandatory. I said, where I differ is I don't think we should ever send anyone into combat that doesn't want to be there. So the draft is mandatory, but there are service options where you can fill your time in a hospital or in some public service program, mm-hmm. and get credit for your mandatory service time. Well, when I first said it was mandatory, that was not popular. When they heard me out, it was a little bit better, but mm-hmm. obviously at that time they wanted to abolish the draft. Mm-hmm. There was no one that wanted a draft system. Ironically, it was eventually a while. We've never formally done away with the draft, but we have essentially done away with it, and we still have one of the better militaries, but you can see who's taking the brunt of it. A lot of reserve units and guard units are really being pressed into service. Mm-hmm. These are very dedicated people. Mm-hmm. And I had the pleasure of serving with them for 20 years. Mm-hmm. The only reason I didn't go to the Gulf War is I went to Africa. I had to actually get out of the reserves to take my African assignment that we'll probably talk about. Mm-hmm. And I even looked for a reserve unit in Heidelberg, Germany, if I could commute from Africa to Heidelberg. And they said, it's all full. There was a reserve unit in Heidelberg, but it was full.
Frank, was Ag Hall affected at all during the days of mm-hmm. campus protests? Were there?
Oh yeah, because T-16 was the ROTC, right down on the corner of Linden and Babcock.
Oh, cool.
That's
right.
Where ROTC was. So obviously the military or the police in formation would, you know, they had these steel helmets and clubs, and they would walk two abreast in four or six rows, mm-hmm. anywhere from 8 to 12 in a group, and they would stay together, and they would try to, of course, watch the protesters. And when the tear gas started being dispersed, of course, a lot of the students would try to run into Ag Hall to get out of the tear gas. Mm-hmm. We were pretty much in the middle of it.
And you must then remember the Sterling Hall bombing.
I felt it. I was living in Sun Prairie then, and I felt the jolt early
really?
In the morning.
Really? That far out?
Yeah. I felt it, because it was just a shake. Mm-hmm. And I was an early riser, and so I was up and around. I think, I forget what time it went off, but it was early in the morning.
It was three or four,
so
something like that.
And then, of course, on the way into work, I heard what was going on. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't even feel that.
So, let me see here.
Yeah, we should.
You get your degree in 1974. conclude this.
Okay.
This now concludes the November 5th, 2009 session with Associate Dean Frank Kustra, not Kustra.
Either way. Actually, my grandfather changed it to Kustra when he got here, but in Holland we would be called Kustra. So the I, if Kustra, you don't hear the I, it kind of gets buried in the S and the O. But Kustra is the Dutch pronunciation.
Yeah. Okay.
But we respond to anything.
Very practical Dutchman.
Yeah.